tonight, on Drive, we're talking about artificial intelligence.
Yeah, there we are. That's the voice of Siri, or otherwise known as the person who keeps trying to talk to me when I'm trying to put my phone on. Computers are everywhere in our daily lives. It's whether it's getting to work with GPS or scanning our fingerprints to pay for shopping. We're relying on intelligent technology more than ever.
Where does that leave humans in the future? Can you coexist with technology peacefully, or are you in trouble?
Well, a new report says more needs to be done to prepare future generations for a world alongside artificial intelligence. MPs on the Science and Technology Committee have called for the government to establish a commission to look at the ethical, legal and societal impact of AI. We're going to get into this further, but first, the acting chair of that committee, Dr. Tanya Mathias, is with us. Hello.
Hello.
What are these ethical issues that need to be addressed?
Well, they're going to affect us in so many fields. I mean, you just introduced that voice recognition. But in almost any area, any job, artificial intelligence robots are going to be with us. So the ethics are going to be on the human control, when things go wrong, who takes responsibility, and managing the workforce as well.
If we'd have had this kind of report and foresight ahead of the Industrial Revolution, of course, those who objected to technology being introduced for fear of their jobs would have had a field day. And is that the main concern now, that a lot of the younger generation listening to this may be out of work because of AI?
That's a very good point, but it's not the fear. I mean, the 1750 revolution, if we look historically, you look back, employment increases, but exactly that took that was a much slower pace than we have now. And we think now this is effectively the fourth industrial revolution. And this revolution is at a pace 10 times faster than that first revolution. But we don't want people to miss out. Long term, it might be optimistic, but we've got to be prepared right now today for whose job might be threatened, and therefore who needs to look at what's called either reskilling or upskilling.
Yeah, while you're saying all that, I'm just wondering if in, I don't know, 20, 30 years' time, the machines will be serving us, or we will exist to serve the machines.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's why we should be thinking about it now, because 20 or 30 years' time is almost unimaginable. But exactly what you're saying. Now, you're in a very strong field because there's creativity involved. But it's right that almost everybody should be thinking, what part of my job could become, in future years, or very quickly, could become the job of a robot, and therefore, if that happens, what does that free me up to do?
Yeah, arguably, though, robots in 20, 30 years' time are not going to resemble the robots we can imagine now, and they may be able to an extent think for themselves. I mean, even thinking of my position, if a robot digested every political interview done over the last 5 years, they could well be able to interview a cabinet minister.
They'd never, at the moment, we don't think they can have those. Yeah. We don't think they can have those flashes of inspiration. So that's where you are protected. They haven't got the reasoning and the learning. But you would always, like a pilot on the aircraft, even if it's on autopilot, you need to have that expertise for those amazing times.
I see
so
that.
There is a reason to be excited and hopeful, but we do have to be thinking ahead.
Tanya Mathias, thank you for that. Ian's just texted in. He says, technology doesn't always work. Look at Samsung. What do we exactly mean then when we talk about artificial intelligence? Are we talking about GPS systems and search engines? Or maybe the Skynet from Terminator? Maybe our imagination is the only boundary. Professor Noel Shark is an expert in artificial intelligence and robotics at Sheffield University, and more importantly, a judge on Robot Wars. Hello, Noel.
Hey, good evening.
Welcome to the programme. So we're banging on about artificial intelligence, but I guess we're only judging it in terms that we understand now, like the sat-nav. But where might it go?
Well, I'm very much in agreement with what Tanya was just saying. I mean, we can kick up a lot of dust about artificial intelligence. Unfortunately, that has happened through sci-fi. But real artificial intelligence, which began in 1956, and I kind of like the early definition, which was the science of making machines do things that would require intelligence if they were done by humans. Now, that doesn't mean that the machine is intelligence. It's just doing things that would require intelligence if done by us. For instance, beating the world champion chess player in 1998. That was brute force, so it was able to search, you know, well ahead, millions of moves ahead. Whereas the human Kasparov had really good, really great intelligence because he's doing high order pattern recognition. And the machine, of course, didn't know it was playing a game. It couldn't care less whether it won or not, and it couldn't make you a cup of tea afterwards. So this is what we call narrow artificial intelligence. And what the holy grail of artificial intelligence, in a sense, is this idea of artificial general intelligence. And we haven't got any kind of handle on that at all yet. And we don't even know if we'll ever be able to do it without some sort of living system. We have no clue yet.
Sci-fi writers have had a field day, haven't they, for decades yes. now on this subject. And Westworld's the big new TV hit at yes. the moment. Michael Crichton delved into that back into the 70s. And that looks at artificial intelligence and that wider aspect of giving them feelings. And do you not think, Noel, that is inevitable, given mankind's desire to improve and over time, even if it takes 100, 150 years, they will strive to do that?
Yes, possibly. I don't know. I mean, I love Westworld, by the way. It's a great show. I'm a big sci-fi fan. But I focus on the second word there, which is science fiction. And, you know, how do we give a machine feelings? As a scientist, I could not say we would never be able to do this. Of course I can't. But we don't understand what emotion is. We don't understand what sentience is. We don't understand what consciousness is. And so it's quite easy to exploit these things scientifically. And I would rather we held off on that and thought about the sort of really difficult problems that the Science and Technology Board have been discussing at Parliament and the new report out today. And there's a new report from the United States as well today from the White House about artificial intelligence. But it's all very grounded in the present.
Yeah.
And so there's like two different kinds of AI. There's AI that we know and it's scientifically with us. We know it's there. And then there's a kind of speculative one. And, you know, robots now can project emotion. They can smile, they can look sad, they can look happy, they can look angry, they can classify your emotions, and so they can respond appropriately, but there's nothing going on in there.
I understand that, but I'll go back to my original point, and this is why these reports are coming out, because underlying them is a fearfulness, isn't it? Because we all understand the AI abilities that we have now. It is what the future will bring, can you ever rule out that there will be artificial intelligence that can think for itself?
No, of course I can't. I'm a scientist. It might be done tomorrow for all I know. But what I've been working in the field for 40 years and I've been so optimistic about it, you know, so many times, because this has come up time and time again from the very beginnings, from the 50s, and we have not seen any sign of it. Machines are certainly getting faster. My iPhone's more powerful than supercomputers were 15 years ago. But the fastness isn't what it is. We haven't cracked out how to program it. And then you have this other thing that's scaring people called machine learning. But I would prefer they call that what it is, which is statistical parameter estimation. But that isn't quite so sexy, is it? It sounds like it's really a learning machine with big data. But all of these things are very, very limited. And I just would rather we didn't go on with the scaremongery about what's going to happen in the future and kick up a dust screen that covers what's happening now, because what we really need to do is we need the public to be properly informed about the nature of AI as it exists now, so that they can make appropriate decisions about what control to cede machines and how our society should control them.
I've got a young boffin with me in the studio, Noel, and she loved your gag there. She was smiling from ear to ear. Sarah Nagir is with me. Hello, Sarah.
Hello.
Noel, by the way, stay with us, won't you, and chip in, please.
Sure,
help
sure.
us out whenever you can. Sarah, you study machine learning then at the University of Manchester.
Yes.
Before we talk about anything else, what's machine learning?
Well, machine learning is, as it was just said before, learning statistical parameters. So it's inferring models from the data. What can we learn from data so we are able to make predictions in the future?
Okay, all right. Well, look, you're of the generation that we seem to be worrying about tonight that may be seriously affected in one way or another, for good or for bad, we don't know yet, by artificial intelligence. Do you have any specific fears of what your generation might face?
Well, I think my generation should get more and more involved with what's happening around and with the field of artificial intelligence, because I have the feeling that machine learning and artificial intelligence are becoming part, more and more part of our lives. And I think it's important that the people get some knowledge about what is artificial intelligence.
But do you need that knowledge to be able to operate Siri? You don't need to know how it works, do you?
True, you don't need to know how it works, but because machine learning and artificial intelligence is becoming more and more prominent in most industries and academia and businesses, I think it's good to have people prepared to what it exactly is, and also so that they can communicate their needs in artificial intelligence.
So it's like computer programming back in the 80s when I was at school. That was the big thing. So in other words, in order to work within the industry, you need to understand what's happening.
I would believe it would be a great plus.
Yeah. All right. Chip in, Sarah. I want to bring in Dave Copley now. Hello, Dave.
How you doing?
I'm all right. Dave, you're the Chief Envisioning Officer at Microsoft.
Yeah, check me out.
Check you out. What does that mean?
It's a comedy job title that we made up. Simply, my job is about projecting out how the future might play out, but the particular sort of aspect of my focus is not really the technology, it's the humans, and it's what we choose to do with the technology that really matters. And it kind of echoes, you know, Tanya's and Noel's points that this technology is going to arrive. The thing that will make it successful or fail is what the humans choose to do with it, and that's why I think this debate is so important to be having today.
Yeah, and we all know from history that humans don't always do the right thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean,
how do you prevent that?
Well, I think, you know, Noel's really landed the point, which is it's about awareness and education. And, you know, to your point, we don't need to have everybody understand how AI works, but it's a bit like a car. Nobody understands how an internal combustion engine works unless you're a petrol head, but you understand the implications of what driving means. You understand the rules of the road. We've got this same principle that we have to have with AI because it powers our lives. If I give you three examples of where AI touches us today, you know, we've been using it for over a decade now with internet search. AI and machine learning in particular has opened up the entirety of the world's knowledge to anybody from a small screen that they carry around in their pocket. Secondly, we can do things like language translation. So, you know, Skype language translation is a great example where I can do real-time speech-to-speech language translation. It's not perfect, but you can imagine that growing. And then the third and final thing is just how much further it's going into our lives. You know, I have a 10-year-old son. It's a reasonable bet that he may choose his lifelong partner on the basis of an AI recommendation. Think about the implications of that in our society.
Well, just enlarge on that thought.
Well,
why?
If you listen to the dating site stats, you know, and how big that they've grown and how successful they're getting at matching people together. Again, if you project out into the future, the accuracy of this prediction is going to get better and better. We'll become more used to using them.
That's why Sainsbury's keeps giving me offers on tomatoes. It knows I like them.
Well, it does, but, you know, that's, again, not a great sort of example because it only knows you like them because you've bought them in the past. They didn't know if your mum was coming round for tea and you were cooking a spag bol that night and you're never going to cook it again. It's not intelligent enough. But what we're seeing now with the advent of things like, you know, forgive the technical term, the cloud, to really services that run at the scale of the internet that make these amazing services possible, they can do more and more with the data that you generate as an individual. So your shopping habits, the things that you do, the things that you search for online. And that brings us to the final part of this puzzle, which is, you know, we talk about AI, but the fuel of AI is data. And we have to have a big conversation as a society about what good data use looks like, because, you know, companies like Microsoft and Google and Facebook, we can do amazing things with your data, but we need to make sure that we get things like privacy right. We need to get the expectations of the individuals right, so we don't scare you by this stuff. We have to win your trust in order to make this possible.
It seems to me that privacy is becoming increasingly a redundant issue in this country, isn't it? And I can see how in 20 years' time it'd be very, very difficult to keep things private, whatever button you press or whatever box you try and tick. Why? Just one for you, Dave, and perhaps Noel, you can chip in on this, and even Sarah. Why does Stephen Hawking say artificial intelligence, and I quote, could spell the end of the human race?
Well, because he's an optimist, right? And he's a pragmatic optimist. You have to get underneath. And what happened when Stephen Hawking made that speech is the headline is we should be worried about AI. And then the copy basically says, I worry about AI because these are the implications. But as an optimist, I can see the huge potential to our society, and we must be so mindful to not forget the great gift that this technology could bring us. We will solve cancer as a result of this technology. You know, that's a huge prize, and there are many other areas of all of our lives that could be touched in a positive way by the power of this technology. It's too big a gift to leave on the table because we can't have the practical debate that this report, Noel and Tanya and everybody else, is trying to drive in our society.
Let's just speak to you're laughing. Why are you laughing?
I'm just laughing about the Stephen Hawking thing, because I was thinking he also predicted who would win the World Cup.
Did he get that right?
No, he didn't. Okay. But he used mathematical techniques.
I'm with you. That's why he doesn't win a million at William Hills every week, then, I guess. Let me just bring in Eugenia Coida now, who's the CEO of Luca, a technology company that makes what they call chatbots. Hello, Eugenia.
Hello.
Hi. Very quickly, what is a chatbot? I want to talk about the particular one that you've made, but what is it?
I guess chatbot is just a conversational... it's an algorithm that can talk to you, something like that, something along those lines. In the recent just months, chatbots were kind of in vogue, so I guess everything is now called a chatbot, so it's hard for me to define it in a more clear way.
Well, let's talk more specifically, Eugenia, then, about what you've done with a chatbot, because it's enabled you in a way to talk to the dead. Just explain what you've done.
With my company, we've been working on trying to build the best conversational experiences for the last 4 years already, or 3.5 years. The idea was to just build the best dialogue model out there, the best technology that will allow a machine to talk like a human, to talk in a human way. And then we were the first company to launch a bot powered by a neural conversational model. And, this is actually, the dialogue model that will be based on machine learning, something you guys talked about earlier. And we also figured out a way to build it using very limited amounts of data.
Specifically on this one, though, you've recreated the voice patterns of someone close to you who's died.
That's correct. We did not do it part of our business or work we do. But since we have this technology in our hands, I figured that, I could basically just take all the texts off my best friend who tragically passed away last year in November and put them all in this algorithm and see whether it will be similar, it will represent him, whether it will actually work.
And does it work? Does it work?
I guess it does.
What kind of things do you ask and what kind of things does he say?
It's not about asking things for me. It's more about, a place where I can go and talk to him, tell him things that, I feel like are important to me. It's more about myself opening up versus, getting a specific response there. Other people use it a little different, A lot of people that, read the Verge article that just made this huge feature on it.
All right, Eugenia, I'm running out of time. Listen, thank you for that. Dave Copland listening into that. That is a case of human intelligence using artificial intelligence to enhance their lives.
And you know what? That is the nub of this. We have to prepare future generations. The successful humans of the future are those that can use the best of technological capability and blend it with the best of human ability. And that's the only way that we get to the right place in this. And we have to start now.
Yes, I agree with that. I agree entirely with that. The chatbots still are not very good, though. I mean, I've been looking at them for years and I've judged them sometimes, and they're getting on okay, but they're missing something. They search through massive data and give you a response, but, and it sounds a bit creepy bringing back the dead. It sounds like something from Charlie Brooker's Black Mirror. He had a whole episode on that, and I don't think that's where I'd want to see AI going, really.
But therein lies the problem, though, doesn't it? Because who can dictate where our AI goes? Because once it's out there, people can use it to their own ends.
Well, it's really trying to dictate where technology's going to go, and we have no idea. And I'm sort of a little bit sceptical, because I know that you take a lot of different inventions, like the television was discovered because you had radio, and then somebody discovered electronic valves, etc. And then some smart person comes along and just sticks all the inventions together. And suddenly you've got mobile phones that you're talking to and looking at people's faces. And so we don't know what new technology is going to come around the corner and make us all gasp.
No.
It could be something really, really big and different than what we've got now, different from computing or anything.
And that's, Sarah, very quickly, our student of machine learning, what is around the corner? Do you know?
I think, well, machine learning can have really, really exciting applications, and I don't believe it's going to harm anybody anytime soon.
Okay.
And I feel I'm very excited to work in machine learning.
Well, good luck to you, Sarah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to Tanya originally as well, and thanks to Dave, and thanks to Noel. We're ending with another message from Siri.
And do we still need Tony Livesey?
I'd like to answer that question, but I haven't got time. I hope so. I'm back tomorrow anyway, so if I don't, there'll be something in my place, maybe a toaster. We'll see you then. Here's sport.
Thank you very much then, Tony. Another miserable evening of international football last night, so we'll revisit it tonight. Bear with us. Henry Winter, Neil Ashton and Sam Wallace are with me for the journalistic side of things. David Pleat provides the football expertise on a Dave Villa of appointed Steve Bruce, and Derby have returned to Steve McLaren. Eddie Hearn will join us for 5 Live Boxing from 9 and bring us the latest on the possible Joshua Klitschko fight. And then from 10 we have an interview with Paul O'Connell.
First for news and the best live sport. This is BBC 5 Live.
Good evening. It's 7 o'clock on 5 Live. I'm Mark Chapman and at BBC.